I'm Christopher Lydon with Steven Pinker, who has written a game changer on the subject of human progress and human violence titled The Better Angels of Our Nature. If it's true, and he calls it science, the best of all possible worlds lies just ahead. Though there are premises to be tested here. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Steve Pinker, you are in so many ways the William James of our time. Here we are in William James Hall with its Occupy sign on the seventh floor at Harvard University. Speaking of William James, brother of Henry, father of pragmatism, author of The Moral Equivalent of War, the giant of public intellectuals 100 years ago. Can you explain this book to the man himself, our leader, the most inclusive of American minds, I think, and still among us in so many ways?
I like to think that William James would appreciate the argument of the book, which is, despite the fact that there is such a thing as human nature, despite the fact that we have plenty of ugly, violent impulses inside us, it is perfectly possible to set up a world in which those impulses don't actually emerge as violent behavior, because there are human nature is a complex system. It has many parts, and among them are a faculty of empathy, a faculty of reason, a faculty of self-control. And so you can appreciate the richness of an evolved human nature. And William James, I call the first evolutionary psychologist. Yeah. He was indebted to Darwin.
Absolutely.
And he made no bones about the fact that we come from ancestors who had to prevail in constant contests of bloodshed. And so we have violent urges. Nonetheless, James was certainly an optimist in his essay, Moral Equivalent of War, arguing that it is certainly possible to set up institutions that would minimize war. He was a famous pacifist. And I like to think that 100 years after his death, he is being vindicated. Now, of course, if he lived 10 years longer, if he had lived 35 years longer, he would have found this hard to believe, because the two world wars were a rude interruption in humanity's movement toward nonviolence. But if he had held on just a little bit longer in being brought back to life, he would see that we're living in an era now in which it wouldn't be too much of an exaggeration to say that war is going out of style, in the sense that old-fashioned interstate wars, two armies on the battlefield, and those are the most destructive kinds of wars, those have been diminishing in number and human toll since 1945. And we're living in a period that may have a record low number of deaths in warfare. And now, what would surprise James is how the argument would be framed today. Because in James's article, The Moral Equivalent of War, Well, nowadays we hear that title and you might guess that he's talking about something that is as bad as war. But in fact, what he was referring to is something that would be as good as war. Because at the time that he wrote, prior to World War I, there was a widespread sentiment among Western artists, intellectuals, poets, writers, that war was a good thing. It brought forth the
best. Surely he didn't believe that. That war was the health of the state, as it was said.
Well, I think he was ambivalent. He felt that he had to, at the very least, accept that premise in order to bring his audience, his readership, to step one of his argument. That he conceded, in fact, that war brings forth qualities of self-sacrifice, of courage, of working toward a cause that's greater than yourself. Now, granted, he also had some fun with this idea. He satirized it because it was so popular at the time. But the point of his article was, okay, let's grant that war prevents people from sliding into selfishness and consumerism and materialism. But can we find a way to elevate ourselves without killing people? And so his argument, which was for a form of what today we would call compulsory national service, kind of Teach for America, Conservation Corps, Peace Corps, where, as he put it, the youths would have the childishness slapped out of them by being forced to work in fishing trawlers and coal mines and factories and emptying hospital bedpans and so on. My instincts are more libertarian than James's, and I would not be in favor of compulsory national service. But nonetheless, it is an advance over sending young people off to war in order to harden them.
I take him differently, and I know that essay well. It's not war is the health of the state at all. He uses that line, and you have one like it, but history is a bath of blood. It's a horribly destructive process, and we've reached a point even before World War I where we can see it's coming to a terrible end. And he's saying, let's use those qualities that you're speaking of, manliness, authority, discipline, you know, a certain martial spirit, but to do everything but war, whether
it's
Boy
absolutely.
Scouts, exploring, outward bound, things that do take civic courage, as he would say, and civic spirit, but not at all.
Without killing people, yeah.
Exactly.
Exactly. No, that's my understanding of him as well. But he accepted that war was effective at inculcating these qualities, something that
well,
would
but no,
and then,
but
then
a,
rejecting that it had to be war, that war was not the only thing that could do this.
The William James piece I love even more than the moral equivalent of war is a speech he gave at the dedication of the Shaw Memorial to the Black Regiment opposite the Massachusetts State House in 1897. And he said, among other things, he said, as you do, that we are all survivors of a chain of massacres. And it's only because somebody in our line had a longer claw or sharper teeth that we're here at all. But he says, man is once for all a fighting animal. Centuries of peacefulness could not breed the battle instinct out of us. And he goes on to say that pugnacity, military valor is easy. It's the civic virtue that's hard. Mm-hmm. 500 people would happily go to, you know, up the hill for a war cause tomorrow, but maybe one among the 500 would speak out against the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right. Very prescient. But he was writing in a time when this was a radical concept. You can see right up to First World War, there may have been some people who had a foreboding that First World War was a disaster, but not enough of them. And there were probably more people, and they weren't just military aristocrats or generals. They were also artists and poets and philosophers who kind of looked forward to the war, which is one of the reasons the war unfolded as bloodily as it did.
But how does your theory, Steve, deal with his line that centuries of peace couldn't breed the war instinct out of us?
I think there's something to that. I think that we're always going to have violent fantasies. I cite a statistic in Better Angels that about 75% of men confess to at least once having fantasized about killing someone that they don't like. When I mentioned this in a lecture, someone yelled out, yeah, and the rest of them are lying. Nonetheless, far less than 75% of men actually act on this impulse. So that's the thing about human nature. We have all kinds of impulses. I would definitely not want the video screen of my imagination to be broadcast to the world. I don't think anyone would. Freud said, paraphrasing Plato, bad men do what good men dream. Mm. And I think James was right about what men dream. But that isn't necessarily what men do, thanks to faculties like self-control. Also, I think we take enormous pleasure in consuming vicarious violence, not just violent video games, but Shakespearean tragedies and the Homeric epics and the Old Testament and Canterbury Tales. All of these are saturated with violence, and we can't get enough of the stuff. We spend a lot of our disposable income and our free time consuming violence because it fascinates us. And I think these are aspects of our psychology that James correctly attributed to an evolutionary history of having to prevail in battles.
But what is your real thought on that? I used to wonder this at hockey games. We would be in Europe. Montreal
Canadiens fan.
We would wait for John Ferguson and Teddy Green to square off at the middle, middle of the ring. And it was awful. But I always wondered, do we go home healthier or more vicious from seeing that kind of thing?
I suspect neither. I suspect it's a guilty pleasure. And that unless it's put in a moralistic context where this is the right thing to do, or a context in which you actually think that there is some threat that can only be defended against through violence, unless you're convinced that that's the world that you live in, I think the vast majority of people are pretty good at compartmentalizing these fictitious worlds. My favorite example is the fact that first-person shooter video games, where people, mainly young men, actually experience the visual sensation of pulling the trigger and massacring people. They skyrocketed in popularity just when the real crime rate sank like a stone. And also there is a tendency in blaming violence on violent media to single out the violent media that other people watch. So we talk about the video games that teenage boys play, but no one says, is it really healthy for people to see Shakespearean tragedies? Because that's a highbrow form of entertainment, and we know that we can watch a stage be filled with dead bodies and not go out and commit murder. But we somehow deny that capability to others.
And still there's a gap, though, between the moral equivalent of war in William James's terms and the better angels of our nature. He was saying people have to be organized in things like Civilian Conservation Corps or Jimmy Carter's moral equivalent of war against, you know, oil consumption or whatnot.
His critics called it meow.
Yeah, exactly. But we have to have a sort of substitute spine for our imaginations. You say even after World War I, World War II, multi-millions killed in the 20th century, that it just happened. You don't have a CCC or a Legion baseball kind of cure. How would you explain to William James what you think happened?
I think things like, you know, boys clubs and boy scouts and so on are probably good for to keep young people out of trouble, because it is most violence is committed by young men 15 to 30 years old, and if you can give them something to do other than compete for status in bars and street corners, you probably will lower the rates of violence. But of course, we're also talking about violence of a very different kind, like wars between nations, which aren't a problem of 15 to 30 year old young men. They're not the ones who declare the wars and organize the armies, but these are men in power. So what changed? I think a number of things changed. To the extent that ideas drive history, and I think ideas do drive history, the idea of universal human rights, which almost sounds like a feel-good saccharine notion, like who could be against universal human rights, it's actually quite a radical idea and a novel idea, and I think one that doesn't come naturally to us, because our natural instinct is to say that the rights belong to the tribe or the clan, and that people who are outside our circle are subhuman or devils. You can blame the world's ills on them. The idea that every last member of Homo sapiens has a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness by virtue of being a member of Homo sapiens, and the fact that they belong to one country or another, can't take away that right. The glory of the nation, the race, the class, can't be allowed to compromise the right of individuals to life and happiness. These are deeply strange ideas, but they have become ascendant, I think, for the first time in history, really, in the years since World War II. So that there's an ideological change. I think there's also the emergence of an international community where world leaders more and more feel that they're part of a club, and there are just certain things you do and certain things you don't do. And whereas it used to be that war was, as Clausewitz said, the continuation of policy by other means, that's no longer the way leaders think of war if they want to be able to rub shoulders with other leaders. War is now almost among respectable states, at least when dealing with each other. Mm-hmm. There are some exceptions, such as the United States with dealing with what it considers rogue states. But say Italy and Austria, it's not that they are constantly threatening each other with war. It's just almost not a concept. It would almost be like a sick joke to bring up war. And I think that's fostered by a change in norms, partly in turn fostered by international organizations like the UN, like the European Union, like the hundreds of other organizations that states belong to. I think the rise of democracy has been another factor. And there are, by the way, statistical studies that try to tease cause and effect out of the mass of correlational data of which states tend to get into military disputes and which tend to avoid them. Democracies generally stay out of the way of other democracies. And you can debate why. Maybe it's because democracies themselves are founded under the principle of peaceful conflict resolution within, and so they externalize it to their dealings with other states. Or it may be that wars are things that benefit leaders, give them lots of glory, put them in the history books, but at the cost of the cannon fodder that they sacrifice. If you have people exerting more control over the decisions to go to war, there'll be fewer wars. Whatever the reason, democracy seems to be somewhat of a pacifying force. And also, I'll mention one more, and that is exchange and trade, that countries that can buy stuff from each other have, and therefore the people in other countries are more valuable to them alive than dead, are less likely to plunder. It becomes cheaper to buy stuff than to steal it, and you're better off if the population of the other country is alive and prospering than dead, if you're part of a global economy. This is the old Enlightenment idea of du commerce, gentle commerce, mm-hmm. that commerce is a pacifying force compared to national glory, rectifying historic injustices, and all of the other non-material motives that in the past often led nations into war.
Steve Pinker, I'm still a little unclear about the seam between this book and an earlier big book of yours, The Blank Slate, in which the moral broadly seemed to me was that nature keeps trumping nurture, that we're stuck with our genes.
Yeah, that would not be the way I would put it. And in fact, in The Blank Slate, I actually kind of foreshadowed the themes of the better angels of our nature. I actually had a couple of paragraphs that mentioned that historically violence has gone down in order to make the point that a commitment to the existence of human nature does not condemn you to perpetual war and strife. And I like to think that William James would agree with this, and he's my hero in being an earlier supporter of an evolved human nature. But the reason is that human nature has multiple parts. There are ugly motives like sadism, like greed, like revenge, like status and honor. On the other hand, there are parts of human nature that can pull us back from violence, like cognitive processes, reason, like empathy, which James wrote brilliantly about,
right.
Like self-control. And moreover, some of those faculties, like reason, like language, are open-ended combinatorial processes. They give you a few pieces and some rules for assembling them into bigger pieces and assembling bigger pieces out of the smaller pieces ad infinitum. And so there's a huge space of possible ideas that the human mind can think. This is an idea that I owe in part to my former MIT colleague, Noam Chomsky, that language is an infinite, open-ended, creative, combinatorial system. Human nature gives us the machinery of language, but once you press the on button, that machinery can multiply out an unlimited number of new ideas. And among those ideas could be ways of outsmarting our inner demons, the darker parts of human nature. We can think up institutions that disincentivize everyone from acting on some of their uglier impulses. And I think human history consists of accumulating some of the better ideas that we've had, like democracy compared to, say, hereditary monarchy or totalitarianism, like peacekeeping forces, mm-hmm. like rule of law, like international organizations, like education, like literacy, all things that are rather unnatural that you don't really find when you just throw a bunch of people living together in tribal conditions. But with a civilization that has literacy and institutions, you can start to build contraptions that give us better ways of living our lives.
Speaking of Chomsky, parenthetically, we don't think of him as an optimist about anything, and yet he did remark to me, I don't know, maybe a year ago, that the Iraq War, much as he despised it, was vastly more merciful than the Vietnam War, say.
Oh, he's absolutely
right. No B-52 bombing, no Agent Orange, no napalm.
No, that he's absolutely right, that the number of deaths, and if you look at the Iraq, separate the American invasion of Iraq, which was
we'll come to that.
A few weeks of shock and awe from the internecine violence thereafter, which was mostly Muslim against Muslim. But the actual war phase was, again, not to defend it, and I'm with Chomsky here, but it was just a fraction of the number of deaths from Vietnam. Vietnam, there were just confining ourselves to the American side, there were, I think, 58,000 combat deaths in the...
And
maybe 2 million Vietnamese. In the Iraq War, even if you include the Muslim against Muslim violence in the anarchy that followed, it's more in the range of 100,000 to 150,000, and the American deaths more in the range of 3,000 to 4,000. So this is, which is not to say that that's a trivial number of deaths and suffering and waste, but still, it's at least a factor of 10 less than what we lived through a few decades earlier.
But here's the question. before we conclude that, you know, every day and every way we get better and better, I mean, I read this book in many sections and said, wait a minute, Steve Pinker, have you been watching the Republican debates? I mean, this cheering for the death penalty, military solutions to absolutely everything. Do you take note of the things that bother me? Mixed martial arts in place of boxing, even the rise of football over baseball. Mm-hmm. And I'm a baseball guy, but over 40, 50 years, it's astonishing. You can't take 10 steps in organized society without seeing a screen with huge guys crashing into each other.
You're reminded of that wonderful George Carlin.
Oh, indeed.
The difference between baseball and football, yes.
In baseball, you just want to go home. But that's a counter trend.
Yes.
Certainly, predator drone robot war.
No, that's
a counter-trend.
No, it isn't. It's a great advance compared to carpet bombing and napalm. It's a precision instrument that has, I mean, I hate the phrase collateral damage because these are human beings that get killed, but a fraction of the number of people get killed, even with the occasional accident with a drone, compared to the old-fashioned methods of artillery and carpet bombing and incendiary attacks. Now, this is
we
not
disagree
to say
there. To me, it's secret, remote, totally impersonal. We have no idea really what happens or who was there on the ground. It's sadistic, barbarous. I hate it.
Well, I can't say I'm a fan of it, but compared to artillery and carpet bombing, it's a massive advance.
I'm just thinking of other things in our world, including, you know, half the world starving and the violence of poverty that are just not touched by this theory of the better angels.
Yeah. Well, a few things. One of them is, I share your revulsion to some of the rhetoric coming out of this year's Republican candidates. Nonetheless, the crazies have all crashed and burned. And probably the survivor, Mitt Romney. I mean, hell, he was our governor in Massachusetts, and we didn't mind him that much. And he'll probably prevail. And like a lot of the sound and fury coming out of the right, I think is in part a reaction to the fact that they keep losing. You go back in the 60s, and what the liberals were in favor of then, the conservatives take for granted now, like racial integration. That used to be an issue. It's not an issue anymore. The liberals won, the conservatives lost. Women in the workforce, women in the military. Spanking of children is down. Toleration of gay people. The issue creeps leftward. So now we're talking about gay marriage. 30 years ago, it was, should gays be allowed to teach? Should gays be allowed to have equal opportunity?
Yeah.
And so I think part of the angry white men of the right, what they're angry about is that they keep losing. And societies are getting more liberal. And I half facetiously talk about a continuum where you've got kind of the feminist uber social democracies of Western and Northern Europe at one end. Then you've got the blue American states. Then you've got the red American states. Then you've got kind of Latin America, Asia, and with the Islamic world and sub-Saharan Africa kind of pulling up the rear. I know this sounds very Whiggish and old-fashioned and, you know, Victorian and progress and all of that thing, but in a lot of areas, that's historically exactly what happened. So take slavery. Slavery was abolished by slavery used to be legal everywhere on earth. You know, the Bible saw nothing wrong with it.
Right.
So-called Greek democracy saw nothing wrong with it. And then a few countries in Northern and Western Europe abolished it. And then England, then the Northern American states. It took a civil war, but the Southern American states came around. Brazil abolished it. Finally, in 1962, Saudi Arabia abolished it. In 1980, Mauritania, the last country on earth in which it was legal, finally struck it from the books. So it took a while, took a couple of hundred years, and it didn't happen instantly, but it did happen. And I think that there may be other institutions that follow that trajectory. And so as scary as the Republicans are now, I think I'm a little uncomfortable talking about forces of history, but I think that it's sweeping them along.
What is it about this book, Steve? It's so endlessly rich and impressive and persuasive and entertaining, too. At the same time, it made me want to fight back on several fronts. The most important one has to do with the perspective and the kind of spirit of it. I kept thinking of a Ghanaian novelist, Aikwe Arma, actually went to Harvard, but went very native and very angry back to Africa. But there's one line that sticks in my mind. I won't get it exactly, but roughly reviewing 400 years of absolutely unbounded violence by the West, Portuguese and English and Americans, that savaged Africa at a peak in the late 18th century. And then he said it was a period known in European history as the Enlightenment. It's this question of our own ability to celebrate our cleverness, to euphemize what we're doing, not to see the other side. And we still, the world you're writing about and that we live in is, can be so unconscious of the suffering that comes with it still, mm-hmm. on half the planet easily. And also, not to mention a few keystrokes that could blow it all up, the spread of nuclear weapons, the increasing talk even now of ways that you might have to use nuclear weapons, etc., scales of violence that would bring all of this down like a house of cards. What's to do about that matter of perspective, fundamental matter of perspective?
Well, it's true that the approach that I take, which I think the reaction that you're having is partly that I don't – the book does not fit into one fairly common narrative on the left that a lot or most or all of the world's suffering is due to the perfidy of Western empires, the kind of post-colonialist perspective that the world lived in harmony, the West came along, spread slavery, exploitation, rapacious capitalism, and so on, and that's what the world's problem has been, and that the solution is to overturn the West or to occupy, to revolutionize, and so on. So that's not the approach that I take. It's certainly not a defense of the West. The West has done a lot of heinous things. There's just no question. But I do try to take a more, I hate to call it a scientific approach, but just an empirical approach of what are the numbers? What's the history? Who did what? What should we value? What should we deplore? Some of the good stuff is going to come out of the West. It doesn't mean that because it came out of the West, it has to be tainted. I think the idea of democracy, the idea of women's rights, the idea of human rights, they're largely Western ideas, and that doesn't make them worse. At the same time, there's no doubt that the West tolerated and perpetrated some horrible atrocities and ought to be ashamed of them. So just take the Africa as an example, and let's take the era of the Enlightenment as an example. Slavery in Africa goes way back before the 18th century. Of course, the Arab slave trade started probably in a couple of centuries after Islamic empires arose, and Africans were enslaving each other well before either Arabs or Europeans arrived, simply because all of the first empires had slavery. What I think is significant is not that the Europeans continued to actively trade in slaves in the 18th century, and of course they deserve to be condemned for that, but for the first time you actually had the idea that slavery ought to be abolished. And that idea did come from Europe, and Europe does deserve credit for it. It did take a long time to put into practice both in Europe, but England abolished first the slave trade, and then it actually committed its navy to enforcing the abolition of the slave trade on the high seas. Most historians consider that to be actually an altruistic act. It didn't really bring England a whole lot. Granted, it took a lot longer than it did, but this radical concept that slavery is an abomination and ought to be abolished everywhere was a product of the Enlightenment. And it wasn't that wasn't the time that slavery first appeared on Earth. That was the seed of the idea that eventually abolished slavery.
You remind me of a wonderful East-West dimension of this whole book and the whole argument. You have a fascinating page on the 21 worst things that people have ever done to each other.
Matthew White deserves credit for that, just to give credit where it's due, yeah.
But it begins with the Second World War at the top. And then you recalculate badness in terms of, percentage of the global population at the time and such thing. You make a variety of corrections. But one of the effects of the corrections is to move a lot of the trouble east. Mm. I mean, in the original list, an awful lot of the worst comes out of Europe. And yet in the revision, the worst thing that ever happened is the Anlushan Revolt in China, which I had never heard of, and maybe you hadn't either.
I hadn't either, to be honest.
But so many bad things, the Mongol conquests, the fall of the Ming Dynasty, etc., turn up to be in the East. Is that the way we should remember it, do you think?
Yeah, you know, I never even thought of it that way.
Really?
No, I didn't.
Of course, the first impression is that it wasn't all the 20th century.
Yes, right.
And the second impression is, wow, wait a sec, there's a lot of trouble out there too, before.
Yeah. Well, the first definitely was on my mind as I scanned that table. The second, not so much. But now that you mention it, it is true that the West is not, as a lot of post-colonial ideology would have it, the source of all the world's violence and evil. I think a fairer reading of history is that the default state is there's violence everywhere. There's tribal peoples engage in warfare with death rates that exceed those of the wars of the 20th century. The first states and empires, wherever they occurred, the West, the East, the South, the Americas, all of them had slavery, all of them had human sacrifice, all of them had the death penalty for frivolous reasons, trivial forms of disagreement. All of them criminalized victimless crimes like sexual offenses. We have a nasty history, and all of us have to take all of our ancestors deserve a lot of the blame for it. And you see it everywhere. I think what's unusual is not violence and war and slavery and exploitation. What's really historically unusual is peace and cooperation economic productivity.
Maybe I'm stuck in that sort of post-colonial liberal mindset or even ideology, but I wanted to quote to you a guy I hugely respect, the sage of Delhi, I call him, Ashish Nandi, who is a Freudian of post-colonialism, comprehensive thinker. But he wrote a piece that speaks directly to this question and the question of what are the real monuments of human violence. The general tendency of your book is to sort of flatten out and universalize the problem, in which there are high points and low points sort of everywhere. Ashish Nandi writes, 20th century science may have produced many wonderful discoveries and miracles, but the gas chambers and the mushroom clouds remain its most resilient symbols.
Yeah.
In other words, not
no,
so?
No. No, for one thing, you don't need gas chambers to kill massive numbers of people. And in fact, most of the victims of the Nazi Holocaust were not victims of gas chambers, but of Einsatzgruppen, the mobile squads of gunmen that lined people up and shot them. And we know that many other genocides, such as the one in Rwanda, can be perpetrated with machetes. So you don't need any high-tech machinery. And certainly the gas chambers were not a high point of science. The science behind them was quite trivial. Poisoning is one of the oldest methods of destruction in the book. Likewise, even Hiroshima. Now, it is true that the nuclear arms race was by far the stupidest thing that our species has ever done. The threat that really gave us nightmares when you and I were young adults was the prospect of all-out thermonuclear war between the U.S. and the USSR. And
true.
That's not going to happen. The worst that could happen would be a rogue state or a terrorist group. Even that, I suspect, is unlikely. But the worst nightmare is behind us. It never happened. As for Hiroshima and Nagasaki themselves, of course, they killed a tiny fraction of the people who died in the Second World War. And more people died in the firebombing of Tokyo than in the atomic blast in Hiroshima. So they were. There's no question that they were horrendous and idiotic things for our species to have developed. But to use that to denigrate or to fail to appreciate the spectacular achievements of science in understanding the birth of the universe, the constituents of matter, the constituents of life, the history of life on Earth, the functioning of the human brain, to say that those don't count because of some war technologies that kill a fraction of the number of people that old-fashioned technologies kill, I think that's a spectacular misappreciation of what our species is capable of.
Fascinating. I want to come back to Ashish Nandi, and I hope I'm representing him half well enough, but he puts the 20th century figure for people killed in avoidable man-made violence at 200 million. He says his total keeps going up as he includes the casualties of he writes, 40 mostly forgotten wars since 1945. But he also includes in the problem the South Asian euphoria over its own nuclear tests, Indian and Pakistani, as symptoms of this violent age that we're still very, very much in. He would say, I think, that we as a culture, as readers and writers, are still not dealing with the problem, and that no literature is up to it yet. He says the greatest writers on human violence are Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, and they never got to see the 20th century.
Yeah. There's a big difference between a reduction and an elimination. And the claim that I make that violence has gone down by a lot is not the same thing as saying that it's been abolished off the face of the earth. So there's no doubt there's a lot of scary stuff around. That the reason that I tell my story in 100 graphs is that you have to have a quantitative mindset to understand history. And we already do. Whenever anyone uses the word more, less, better, worse, they are implicitly committing themselves to a claim about numbers. They often don't look at the numbers. I try to the extent that the numbers exist. And what the numbers show is that war hasn't disappeared, nuclear weapons haven't disappeared, murder hasn't disappeared, rape hasn't disappeared. But they're a lot less frequent than they used to be. And you can't appreciate that just by ticking off all the cases of violence that that you can think of that get reported in the news, because you've got to take into account all the places on Earth where wars aren't taking place, where people are dying of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and cancer, and they don't have camera crews at the foot of their beds filming their deaths.
We're going to get to the sins of journalism. Keep going.
But the chances that a person born on in the last half of the 20th century will die of violence, or for that matter, the first half of the 20th century, are actually pretty small. Most we call World War II World War II, but even that, and that's clearly the worst thing that has ever happened on Earth in terms of absolute numbers. But of course, if you were in the Americas, if you were in South America, if you were in large parts of the world, then you weren't going to get killed there either. And then since World War II, that was the worst. Since then, the probability that someone will die in warfare is very, very small. It's almost certain that any randomly selected person on Earth is going to die of something other than war.
Depends a lot where you're living, Steve.
Yeah, so that's why I said a randomly selected person on Earth. If post hoc you pick the most violent spot on Earth, well, yeah, by definition, it's a violent spot on Earth. And what it says is violence. Rates of violence haven't gone down to zero, and I realize they haven't gone down to zero. And if you say, well, let's look where violence exists and say, hey, violence still exists there, what you're doing is you're confirming that violence has not disappeared. Only when you, instead of saying, well, let's look at what it's like to live in the most violent spot on Earth, and we'll pick it because it's violent, if instead you say, well, let's spin the globe with our eyes closed, put our finger down on a spot on the Earth and say, is someone under my fingertip going to die of violence? The answer is almost certainly not.
One more try with Ashish Nandi. On the matter of the spirit and the kind of the method of the way we approach these things, and you approach these things, he's writing in an essay long before you wrote this book. Indeed, after World War II, he writes, the great theorists of violence have increasingly come from outside literature. They have come from psychiatry, psychology, philosophy, even biology and ethology. It's as if our literary imagination failed to grapple with the scope and range of violence in our life, as if we had to set up a second line of defense by further professionalizing the issue. What if all the measures aren't quantitative?
Well,
what if the ultimate measures are not quantitative, including our dread of violence, our fear of violence?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly true that there's a whole psychology of fear and anxiety about violence that, you're absolutely right, doesn't track the actual risk of violence. And of course, it is a big factor in the quality of life. Do you walk out your door expecting to be raped or kidnapped or murdered, or do you think about other things? And that may not track the objective risk. The whole rationale of terrorism, by the way, is to manipulate that bit of our psychology, because terrorism really doesn't kill a whole lot of people. Even the worst terrorist act in history was 9/11. That was fewer than 3,000 people, and far more people die in car accidents, electrocutions, falling downstairs, and so on. But what terrorism does is it gives you the maximum psychological impact. That's why we call it terrorism. It's a technology of terror per actual damage done. But to go back, I think that the issue of what artists have done, I think they've done a lot, actually. And so, for example, the huge mindset shift after World War I, where war went from being seen as glorious and spiritual and honorable and holy and thrilling and manly to being stupid and wasteful and cruel and unavoidable, was in part a product of the post-war artists, of T.S. Eliot, of Jean Renoir,
Picasso,
of even the Marx Brothers. I mean, I say the greatest anti-war film of all time was Duck Soup.
I love that part of your book.
And likewise, during the Vietnam War, there it happened in real time. It didn't have to wait a decade after the war. But we had all of those great anti-war anthems from the folk and the rock musicians. We had the satires like the Smothers Brothers and like MASH and Alice's Restaurant and Country Joe and the Fish. The artists, not necessarily the highbrow artists, and I think that a lot of intellectuals equate art with highbrow art, whereas often it's the middlebrow art that has the biggest societal impact, like the Marx Brothers, like Arlo Guthrie. But the middlebrow artists, I think, have an effect in helping to shift sensibilities, and in this case, from one that took it for granted that war was a good thing to taking it for granted that war was a bad thing.
So how do we explain the Iraq War, which we entered on false premises?
Mm-hmm.
We smashed a country that, for all its evil, was no threat to us. A $5 trillion war that was barely debated, even now is kind of, we haven't owned up to it.
Mm-hmm.
We're told, and we worry seriously, that we've entered an era of permanent war. How can this be in an enlightened, modern, democratic, open, distracted, but supposedly intelligent society?
Well, the interesting thing is, by a lot of these measures, the United States is not at the leading edge, not the vanguard. And the United States—
Of violence or enlightenment?
Of enlightenment. That is, that it's the United States is a bit of a laggard. And of course, the Iraq War was famously opposed by France and Germany, some of our closest allies, and England was much more divided, and Blair's reputation is permanently sullied for being, as everyone said, Bush's poodle. And of course, there was some considerable opposition in this country, not from our democratic politicians, unfortunately, or at least not enough. So it's a little misleading to concentrate on the United States, because the United States is a bit in the rear guard of this. Even then, as we mentioned earlier, the actual Iraq war, the war itself, was by historical standards a far less destructive war than earlier wars like Vietnam, Korea, Iran, Iraq, Russians in Afghanistan, in terms of the number of people that it killed. And it's also, interestingly, it's now been 8.5 years, and it might be even the last of the old-fashioned wars of two national armies fighting each other on the battlefield. There's a sense in which it didn't lead to permanent war, and that wars of that kind have been the last gasp.
I still wonder. Small story, but it spans your range. I was in Tunis at the height of the Iraq War, and out of my Latin high school subconscious came that phrase from Caesar, Carthago delenda est, Carthage must be destroyed. And I thought, Fallujah delenda est, what are we doing in Fallujah? Well, we don't know, but it must be destroyed. And it was pulverized. And I think, in a Pinker scale, what has changed between that unleashing of destructive power from over 2,000 years?
What changes the percentage of the population that's killed, which is lower? If you concentrate on the worst parts of the world during the worst weeks in their history, then there's no doubt that there can be bad things that happen in particular parts of the world at particular times. But if you if you zoom back and you look at period of years, you look at the entire globe, then the worst events are less frequent. They occur in fewer places, and they kill fewer people when they do occur. So that's the way that I look at it, which again is not to deny the horrendous suffering that can befall people in the midst of a war, or the stupidity and preventability of particular wars, and I would certainly classify the Iraq invasion as one of them. But I don't think it's the wave of the future. I think it's the widespread opposition in the rest of the West. The fact that there's an enormous skittishness about repeating it. By the logic that led this country into Iraq, we really should be invading Iran, and that's not going to happen. We didn't put boots on the ground in Libya or Syria, and the Iraq war did not open up a new chapter where we're constantly invading other countries, but rather may have closed the book on that.
Steve Pinker, what do you take to be the politics of this book? How do we apply it? How will it be applied? Is it premature to worry that this will be seized upon by the warrior class as proof that, you know, nobody gets hurt, it's okay, we'll get out of it. We had a worse past. They did more evil things in the Middle Ages, et cetera, or in China in the 7th century.
No, I don't think so. And certainly it is not a left-wing book, but it's certainly not a right-wing book. And I've gotten plenty of flack from the right about not giving Christianity pride of place in the move toward nonviolence. And I think Christianity has a lot to explain from
it. Does. And I just say parenthetically, I rejoiced in your very careful demonstration of what we sort of knew, that the Bible, especially the Old Testament, is worse than Homer for celebrating violence.
Yeah, the Old Testament is one long celebration of bloodshed, of genocide, of rape, of tyranny. Absolutely. So
bring back
religion.
The foreskins of hundreds and thousands of Philistines, et cetera.
Yeah, right. At best, they'd be lucky if it's just the foreskins. And also, the winners in this story are really the not the hard left, but certainly the classical idea of liberalism, of that we should not stick with tradition and authority and religion and custom. We should not resign ourselves to the ways that our ancestors did things, that we can think our way to a better way of living. So it is an intensely progressive message, though not a leftist message necessarily. And I, if there's a politics to the book, it's pro-enlightenment, pro-reason, pro-science, guardedly optimistic in the sense that human nature does not consign us to permanent strife and conflict, because part of human nature includes a faculty of reason, which we can choose to exercise and accumulate the better of our discoveries. And so I avoid pigeonholing myself in terms of the left-right political continuum, but very much situate myself in what I think of as classical liberalism, enlightenment humanism, secular humanism, celebration of reason and rationality.
This book could be a game changer, truly, in the way we think of where we are in the world. And we eternally think of ourselves as on the brink of absolute disaster, perhaps because our journalistic instincts are so bad. But how do you expect it to be digested? Oh, the threat is over, or we do need more civilian conservation corps and really good organizations, or what?
Yeah, the portrayal of journalism is mixed, because on the one hand, it does needlessly scare people and depress people by focusing on
the
events.
It depressed me as a journalist.
Yeah,
our tendency invariably to scare headlines, cultivate the bad news, moral posturing, eternal warning. I mean, it's an embarrassing record. Go on. Yeah.
On the other hand, it is journalists who make the suffering in the rest of the world real to us, and that allow us to, first of all, know about events, not historically when it's too late to do anything about them, but in media race as they're unfolding.
And there's Nicholas Kristof right on the edge. I mean, he's made a career of going to Indian whorehouses and starving.
Oh, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Sierra Leone. And,
exactly. Yeah. And he wrote about your book the other day. Wait a second. What if good news is around the corner? Or what if we've been ignoring the huge trend in the real world?
See, and I think what Nicholas Kristof was picking up on is a theme that is very salient to him. Namely, if you convince people that parts of the world are just hell holes, there's just nothing you can do. They're just going to kill each other. And it's a rat hole. Why even bother to prevent them from killing each other? That can lull people into a kind of fatalism. Joshua Goldstein, a political scientist, notes that if you look at some of the below-the-line commentary on the electronic version of Kristof's op-eds, people often say, well, that just shows we Africans can't run their own affairs. We should recolonize them. Of course, Kristof himself would be horrified by this suggestion.
And that was sort of the moral of the Save Darfur, too.
It could be. But if, on the other hand, you look at the numbers and not just the worst cases and you say, well, things are bad in some parts of Africa, but let's step back and look at Africa as a whole. Actually, it's gotten a lot better. There are fewer wars. They kill fewer people. Parts of the world of Africa that we think of as being overrun by teenagers with AK-47s now have functioning governments and girls going to school and people selling their crops. That tells us that what we do can make a difference. No, we shouldn't write it off as a hellhole. We shouldn't recolonize it. Africans are perfectly capable of living in peace if the right institutions are in place. Likewise, journalism. So, by the way, that's why the optimistic spin of this book, which one might have thought a crusader like Nicholas Kristof would have found offensive, he actually embraced. Because and to his credit, in his own columns, he makes it clear that these are not permanent parts of the way Africa or Southeast Asia lives, that there can be improvements. That's why he's writing about them in the first place, not to depress people, but to try to mobilize people to do what works and avoid what doesn't work. And that's very much my theme as well. Again, in defense of journalism, it seems to me that the real-time coverage of war, including not just clashes of armies on the battlefield, but war's effects on civilians, which is made easier by television cameras and photojournalism and real-time conveying of images and footage back to the home front, might be responsible in part for the growing repugnance against war that we've seen in the post-World War II years, Vietnam really crystallizing it. As I write in the book, in an age in which you can open the paper...
Forgive me, but I have to interrupt you. I mean, Vietnam, and I can see George H.W. Bush saying, we licked that syndrome. We licked the Vietnam syndrome. Oh, yeah. We can go to war again. It's okay. I think we're still in that era.
I don't think so. I don't think we could fight a war that killed 2 million civilians, including napalm, carpet bombing, massive relocation of people out of their villages in order that we could destroy them. It's just of a completely different scale. Mm. And granted that there have been wars since then, but you plot them on a graph and each peak is lower than the preceding one, and by a lot. Again, going back to the role of journalism, an age in which you can open the paper and you see a naked, terrified girl running from a napalm attack is not an age in which, like 100 years ago, people could have said war brings out the best in mankind, which people did say in the time of William James. And I think the presence of images that vividly display the suffering caused by war and terrorism and famine can have effect of mobilizing people against them, particularly if combined with the message that it doesn't have to be this way. There are some things that work.
Come back to William James and a wacko theory that I wouldn't try out on anybody but you. I think of sort of 100-year history as an argument between William James and his wayward student, Teddy Roosevelt, whom James didn't like. He thought he was a bumptious, over-aggressive, over-ambitious kid. I mean, learned to fight at Harvard, became a boxer, all that stuff, went on to become president of the United States. And when you look at the post-Civil War period in the United States, there are two wonderful books that come to very, very different conclusions about this James Roosevelt argument. Lewis Menand wrote The Metaphysical Club about sort of the triumph of pragmatism. And William James, again, in a kind of post-Civil War remorse, we've got to do better, we've got to think up better ways, etc. Jackson Lears has written a book about the same period in which the spirit of Teddy Roosevelt reemerges in George W. Bush, this kind of... William James was, of course, an anti-imperialist. Roosevelt, one of our most eminent imperialists. But let's charge up the hill. Let's prove who's strongest, carry the big stick, and all that sort of thing. It reemerged in a big way, it seemed to me, in the last few presidencies, certainly the Bush ones. I wonder, does that make any sense of a sort of contest between these two people who were probably arguing vehemently about it in the 1880s or 90s at Harvard?
No, I think that is an interesting way of putting it, and I think that has been a tension within, particularly within this country. It's Roosevelt, of course, was from the Northeast, but more often it's a blue state, red state contest between the coasts, basically the coasts in the North compared to the South and the Southwest. America really is, in many regards, two countries, and it's precisely these two poles that define them. There's the continuation of the European Enlightenment, and there's something more of a culture of honor, as anthropologists call it, the idea that the prime virtue is manliness and a willing to defend yourself with violence if necessary.
That's William James and Teddy Roosevelt right there.
Yeah, I believe it is. And I tend to think that it's not a smooth linear progression. It's more of a creeping sideways with a number of reversals and bumps. But I tend to think that it's the Enlightenment tradition that is the way history goes.
Steve Pinker, this is an astonishingly learned, fascinating, challenging book. I can't thank you. I can't admire you enough for it. I hope you're right. I had a feeling reading it, I never need to read another book in my life. This is it. This is everything.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
Great pleasure.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feedback on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.